From the opinion pages of the Wall Street Journal, this is Potomac Watch.
Democrats try to stop Bernie Sanders' momentum before the South Carolina and Super Tuesday primaries and a heated debate in Charleston on Tuesday. Did they succeed? Plus, the coronavirus gets political as you knew it would. Welcome. I'm Paul Gigot with the Wall Street Journal, here with Kyle Peterson. Hello, Kyle.
Hello.
And Kim Strassel, as usual. Hi, Kim.
Hi, Paul.
Let us talk about and dissect the debate. Kim, do you have any thoughts on who emerged as the stronger contender here, or was it just one big mess? I think the latter is true, but did somebody else was a clear victor?
Well, I'm not saying that there was a clear victor. You certainly knew who was in the gun sights of everyone, and that would be Bernie Sanders, who, of course, is the front runner now, and every other candidate trying desperately to emerge as the alternative, more centrist rival to him. And so you saw Joe Biden go after him on his previous opposition to gun control. You had Pete Buttigieg go after him, saying he'd be a drag on the down ticket ballot if he were the nominee. Amy Klobuchar went after his Medicare for All proposals. Even Warren this time, who she's been very soft on Bernie, but she said that she's the one that's done all the work on progressive policies, and she's the one that can be trusted to get stuff done. So he was getting it from all sides. However, they were all seemed to be searching for a place that they could really hit him on, and they didn't rally around one, and they didn't really go into the issues that would really matter about the destructiveness of his agenda. So I think he still emerges from this the front runner, despite what happens in the South Carolina primary.
Kyle?
I would have to agree. And even while they were mounting some of those attacks, they were very careful to try to not offend his supporters. I mean, Elizabeth Warren said, "I agree with Bernie on a lot of stuff.
I agree with Bernie on everything. I'm just better at it.
I just think that I would be a better president," is what she said. Biden tried to go after him on gun control, saying he'd voted several times against gun control bills. That doesn't seem like a very fruitful line of attack for me, simply because, Bernie has moved a little bit more toward a gun control position. But is there anybody who doesn't think that he's sincere about that and that he wouldn't actually want to pass an assault weapons ban? I mean, I think it's an attempt to expose some hypocrisy that is not quite there under the surface. And then I think that some of the attacks just were not sustained in the way that they really needed to be effective. I mean, the one point where I think they got under Bernie's skin was when they were talking about his praise for the Fidel Castro regime in Cuba. He got a little bit cranky about that in his replies, but nobody really followed it up. I mean, he said the literacy went up there. What are you guys opposed to literacy? Nobody said, yeah, but caloric consumption went down over that same period by like 12% if you look at the numbers. Nobody had a Cuban voter that they could call out and say, you know, while you're praising Fidel Castro, this is a supporter of mine whose parents had to flee in the violence. And I mean, nobody really took it to him in a sustained way that I think they needed to.
I guess I would agree with you both about the extent of Sanders in terms of the Democratic primary. I would say, though, that they did open up some vulnerabilities that I think will be exploited in the general election by Republicans. And Cuba is one of them, Kyle. I think there was an astonishing moment for me when Mr. Sanders was asked about his refusal to attend the AIPAC conference. That's the American-Israel Political Action Committee. I think I got that title wrong, but that's essentially it. It's the American pro-Israel lobby, and they're having their convention, annual convention on the weekend, and Bernie Sanders is refusing the invitation. And not only that, but he refused it with prejudice in a couple of tweets. "The Israeli people have the right to live in peace and security," he tweeted. "So do the Palestinian people. I remain concerned about the platform AIPAC provides for leaders who express bigotry and oppose basic Palestinian rights. For that reason, I will not attend their conference. He said that in a tweet. He was asked about it. And here's what he said, which I think was an amazing moment. He said, the answer, it's something that we should take into consideration, moving the embassy to Tel Aviv from Jerusalem. Then he said, I'm very proud of being Jewish. I actually lived in Israel for some months. But what I happen to believe is that right now, sadly, tragically, in Israel, through Bibi Netanyahu, you have a reactionary racist who is now running that country. End quote. So he has accused Bibi Netanyahu of being a reactionary racist. And he didn't really get a lot of pushback, or if any, from his competitors on that. And I just think that that opens up a big vulnerability in the race going forward. And I think Democrats, who have traditionally been also pro-Israel, ought to make that point. Bloomberg really didn't do that, Kim.
No, and to your point about the importance of this in a general election and the vulnerability, here's a great statistic. So in the state of Florida, which obviously every year is a battleground, its electoral votes are absolutely crucial to getting the majority you need to become president. 70% of Florida's 600,000 Jewish voters are Democrats. And those voters have traditionally expected Democratic politicians to express solidarity with Israel. This is the kind of statement that could turn off a great deal, a huge number of those voters, and turn them against Bernie. And that's why, you know, it's interesting when we talk about these primaries. Sometimes we do so very much in a horse race fashion, who is up, who is down. But if you step back, the point of these is not just to see how candidates perform, but to expose their vulnerabilities and to give voters a chance to gauge how big of a problem that would be in a nominee in a general election. And that, to me, is what you saw happening at that debate last night.
It's interesting. The other Democrats didn't really take advantage of that with Bernie. And I think that foreign policy may emerge here as one of his big vulnerabilities. I thought the best answers on foreign policy were Bloomberg. I thought that he gave a real solid answer at some point on foreign policy, but unfortunately, he was vulnerable on so many other things that you barely noticed, Kyle. Not least that really weird moment at the start when, in response to Bernie Sanders, he just blurted out, "Well, that's why Russia is supporting you for the nomination," and then he just shut up. He didn't say anything, didn't elaborate, didn't explain, didn't say what the context was. Just a striking misfire.
And not quite, and almost as weird as his very, like, ill-timed joke at the end about how great he did in the first debate.
And don't forget the urban cowboy joke, too, which
nobody got.
Yeah, exactly.
I mean, he was better. Bloomberg was better, obviously, than in the first debate when he fell completely flat. He had much better answers for some of the predictable questions that he was going to get. But it is true that he spent almost all of the debate on defense, talking about the non-disclosure agreements his company signed, talking about stopping frisk, talking about big gulps, talking about redlining, talking about why he won't release his tax returns, or hasn't done so yet, at least. Even he is sort of hedging and not taking on Sanders in a frontal way. What I thought was one of the interesting moments, I thought, was Tom Steyer was actually the guy who took on the idea of socialism. Tom Steyer said at one point that he doesn't like Bernie Sanders' solutions, but he says, quote, "I don't believe that a government takeover of large parts of the economy makes any sense for working people or for families. We need to present an alternative that includes a vibrant, competitive private sector." I mean, why can't you get those words coming out of Mike Bloomberg's mouth? I don't understand.
I don't either. I really don't either. Kim, do you have a thought? You're a former New Yorker.
Unfortunately, yes. No, I mean, the only thing I can say is that Bloomberg seems to be suffering from the same problem as all of these candidates on the stage, which is there are many ways to engage in a full frontal assault on Bernie's policies, but nobody is willing to do so because they are afraid of offending Bernie's progressive voters. And I understand that calculation to a certain degree, in that this is a crucial part of the Democratic coalition. But, you know, know, we are hurtling toward this moment where Bernie Sanders could be unstoppable. And the way that you're going to rally more of those centrist moderate Democrats around you is to point out the real dangers of his agenda. And nobody's willing to do that. It's not just Bloomberg. I thought that was one of Steyer's finest moments up there on stage in a debate that where not a lot of people had a lot of time to engage in anything of substance.
We'll have some more on the Democratic Charleston debate, as well as the politics of the coronavirus. And you're listening to Potomac Watch from The Wall Street Journal.
This message comes from Viking, committed to exploring the world in comfort. Journey through the heart of Europe on an elegant Viking longship with thoughtful service, destination-focused dining, and cultural enrichment on board and on shore. And every Viking voyage is all-inclusive with no children and no casinos. Discover more at Viking.com.
From the opinion pages of the Wall Street Journal, this is Potomac Watch.
Welcome back. I'm Paul Gigot with Kyle Peterson and Kim Strassel. We should talk about Elizabeth Warren briefly. I want to make the point that she seems to have a special, basically relentless desire to take apart Mike Bloomberg. As you said, she was very gentle with Bernie Sanders, essentially saying, I agree with him on just about everything. I'm just be more effective in implementing it, in part because I'm willing to take down the filibuster and Bernie isn't, which is a strange state of affairs. I think that if he got in the White House, Bernie Sanders would take down argue for taking down the filibuster. That's my belief. But when it comes to Bloomberg, she just kept repeating the themes of the previous week and she wouldn't let up. And I don't quite get that because I don't think Bloomberg is her real problem right now. I think it's the fact that she hasn't galvanized enough people on the left and hasn't carved out enough support in the middle from Mayor Pete and the rest.
Well, I mean, I'd say a couple of things to that. One is that Warren has a particular reason to be gentle with Sanders because she is not going to be a candidate whom moderate voters, Klobuchar voters, are going to rally around. The other thing is, I mean, she may just be repeating what works. Bloomberg is a really great foil for her because sort of similar to Sanders, she talks a lot about corruption and billionaires and campaign finance. And so she's he's a great foil for her. And after the last debate, I mean, her performance taking him down was praised, widely praised. She raised $9 million in 3 days. That money is going to keep her campaign going forward. And so she may have just been looking for a repeat.
The other point I saw from a couple of people on Bloomberg was the Bloomberg in the ads in between the debate was a lot more appealing than the Bloomberg who was in the debate. CBS News ran some of the Bloomberg ads, and they were pretty good, I have to say. But let's talk about Joe Biden because South Carolina really is, could be Joe Biden's last stand. He needs to win that. He's leading in the polls. He really pressed his support among African Americans and pushed in particular back on Tom Steyer, who has been doing pretty well in South Carolina. I think he's third behind Biden and Sanders in the state polling, largely due to his the amount of money he's put into statewide advertising and organization in South Carolina. So Bloomberg tried to take some of the shine off that appeal by attacking Steyer on his investment in a for-profit prison company. And I don't know how effective that was. But Kim, did you think that Biden did enough to look like he could still win South Carolina?
Yeah, maybe enough. I mean, it wasn't a sterling performance for Joe Biden. It wasn't his worst. It probably wasn't his best. Joe Biden is simply Joe Biden, which means when he gets an opportunity to talk, sometimes it's a bit rambling. His attack on Steyer was all about the black vote because not only has Steyer put a lot of money into South Carolina. And he played everywhere, but he really made South Carolina the place he wanted to make a mark. But he's been doing well among African-American voters in that state. And so the Joe Biden attack was a clear attempt to try to peel back some of that support and shore up his standing in the state. Steyer, I thought, had a, you know, he didn't have a great response to that, the claim that he had invested in this private prison. He said, well, once I find out they were doing terrible things, I immediately got out of it. Biden said, that's what we call Tommy come lately. That was the Joe Biden line of the night. Steyer talked about how he had done his own investment in a bank to support black ownership of business. So they were very much vying for that. We'll see on Saturday where those numbers come out.
Yeah, the one thing that I would add, I mean, who knows what the polling, whether the polling is accurate. Biden widely underperformed in Iowa, we now know. But the one moment that I thought was interesting was when he, you know, he was speaking and other candidates started jumping in and he got a little fire in his belly and he said, you know, I'm not out of time. You spoke over time. I'm going to talk. And then there were huge cheers in the audience. At least that's what it looked like watching it on TV. I mean, who knows who's in that crowd. But there was clearly, at least it seemed to me, some, you know, home team support there.
The other interesting thing that happened, and this is on Wednesday, is James Clyburn, who is the dean of the South Carolina Democratic House delegation, a member of the House leadership, endorsed Joe Biden, African-American, endorsed Joe Biden for president. And no doubt he had been courted heavily by some of the other candidates, yet went for Biden. That will help him in that state because, especially with older African-American voters for whom Clyburn is a real role model and widely admired. So let's turn to, we'll see what happens. It's going to be fun to watch on Saturday and then going into next Tuesday. Let's talk about the politics of the coronavirus, which are emerging as a new flashpoint, as it inevitably would. Nothing in America now stays apolitical for long. The Trump administration submitting a request for $2.5 billion of additional spending to counter the virus and potential spread here. We have 57 cases so far in the United States, no deaths. Most of those are people who've been transferred from the boat or moved or evacuated from China and elsewhere. So far, not a breakout, but the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention, a woman from the disease division came out and said that the spreading in communities in the United States will happen. And that sent the Dow Jones Industrial Average and the stock markets down another 3% on Tuesday. And Larry Kudlow, Kim, the White House economic advisor, said, we've got this under control. From India, President Trump has been tweeting that he thinks it's all under control as well. Democrats, I think, sense vulnerability here and are saying, blaming the administration's incompetence. They're saying they're too late, too little, and not asking for enough money.
Well, let's be clear that given those numbers that you've expressed and given all the great work the United States has done helping the international community with its own problems and trying to get this under control, we have done a good job so far. I think they're being honest and trying to warn Americans and just set expectations properly about the likelihood of there being a spread of this virus in the country. We're seeing it in other places now. Obviously, Italy, Brazil just now has a confirmed that they've got cases, and it's just going to happen. It is the nature of this kind of an outbreak. But Democrats, yeah, they do see a vulnerability. They're hoping, I think somewhat cynically, to blame whatever happens and whatever spread comes on the Trump administration lack of planning or lack of planning. So they've come out immediately slammed that $2.5 billion request as inadequate. And that was the first of their jabs to try to position themselves to say, if we were in control, we'd be doing this better.
Yeah, I mean, it does seem like there's a political vulnerability and that the Trump administration senses that in that if the amount of money that they ask for is less than what was allocated in previous pandemic threats, such as swine flu, and then if this thing gets out of hand, I mean, there's they have a political problem there trying to explain why they did what they did. And so it'll be interesting to see whether Republicans on the Hill also start pushing for a little bit more money here. Though, again, there's a lot of ifs in that.
Just as political protection. I mean, I have been through these events before, Kyle, and what happens inevitably is Congress decides to Congress sees an opportunity to spend more money and says, I'll see you and raise you. And now you have, you know, state and local grants in this Chuck Schumer proposal. He came out on Wednesday. First of all, he criticized the proposal and floated a number of $3.1 billion. A day later, he's now $8.5 billion in coronavirus funding and for all kinds of purposes. And you'd have to, if you peeled off the top of that, I bet you'd find out there's a whole heck of a lot of pork in there. The big one of the big problems right now is the detection, the testing packets that the CDC had prepared and manufactured. They turned out to be defective, so they had to be recalled. So they have too few of those, and a lot of the money for the CDC, Kim, you've looked into this in more detail, but they are for things like masks and testing kits and other protective gear.
Yeah, the it's worthwhile going through the numbers, because if Democrats are going to be out there saying we need more, then we need to be talking about more for what. And if you look at what the administration is proposing of this $2.5 billion, about $1 to $1.5 of it is they want to put toward a vaccine development and also money for purchase, because they found that you can't convince vaccine makers to actually do these kind of projects mm-hmm. and invest if you don't have a buyer. So that's all makes sense. You've got another $250 million for a national stockpile of everything from masks to suits and these test kits that they're working on. And then the last tranche of money would go to the CDC to pay it back and continue funding all the work it's been doing on exfiltrating Americans from other countries that came down with the disease, quarantining them, housing them during that time, flying them around from country to country. So that makes a lot of sense. Do we need more money? I laugh when I see the Democrats talking about these grants. Somebody from the administration noted to me yesterday that for the last 20 years, we have been giving approximately $670 million a year to states for grants to prepare for a pandemic. So, right.
And you know where that went, Kim.
Yeah, where did that all go, right? And so now, you know, here's the federal government turning to the state saying, okay, get out your plans, the ones you've been working for the past 20 years. And the states are saying, no, you get out your checkbook. So, you know, I think that that's kind of the game that you were describing. And it's going on again here, just as we saw it with Ebola, just as we saw it with other past health threats.
The other potential vulnerability here, and maybe be the biggest in the end, is the economic impact. If it turns out to be substantial, more substantial than it is now, I think the stock market this week, with its significant correction, has been saying that they're repricing the value of assets based on some greater damage to the economy and to corporate earnings than they had anticipated before. And how much that is, we don't know. As we're talking here, the market is back up a little bit on Wednesday. We don't know if that's a dead cat bounce or if it's a real start of a bottom. But what we think, but if there was a real decline in GDP that bordered on a recession later this year, Kyle, I think and Bernie Sanders is the potential nominee, then that would, for the Democrats, then that would suggest, I think, that that Sanders's chances of winning the election go up substantially. And that, in turn, would have a real, I think, negative impact on markets because of the Sanders agenda. I don't say that I say that just as an analyst about what Sanders' agenda would do to market confidence.
It does seem that, there are at least a decent number of people who voted for Trump because they didn't like the alternatives and they are loving the Trump economy. We have, really low unemployment. We have wage growth going up. And that has been a big part of Trump's pitch, at least so far, for his second term. And so I do think you're right that there's a threat there if we end up in a recession in a couple months. That's a big problem for the president's reelection effort. And it does seem like the threat is there. I mean, some of the charts that I've seen on, for instance, travel within China are really low. I mean, it seems it's hard to know what is happening coming out of a country where you can't always trust the statistics and stuff like that. But it seems like there's a good chunks of the country that are shut down. And if that keeps going on, how that will affect the global economy, it's hard to know.
Yeah, I don't think we know. I mean, we're not close to, in my view, a recession given the solid foundation of the U.S. economy and low unemployment, wage gains, and a pretty good housing market that is coming back as well. But it bears watching, and the markets will react accordingly. So it will have political impact, the coronavirus, before this is over. Thank you, Kim. Thank you, Kyle. Thank you all for listening. We will be back later in the week for another edition of Potomac Watch.